is my proud honor to welcome everyone to today's Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobbies that provides CCL supporters with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics related to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and today's topic is specifically a guide to communicating carbon pricing. The training is going to help CCL volunteers improve our communications around carbon pricing policy based on the main findings and recommendations in the Guide to Communicating Carbon Pricing report. And we're going to have those authors on the line with us. So let me introduce them, and then I'll pass it both first to Tom and then to George. George Marshall, you may have heard of him. He's been a featured CCL national speaker in prior months, is the founder of Climate Outreach, the leading specialist in Europe in climate change communication. George has 30 years experience at all levels of communication and advocacy, from community level movements to senior positions in Greenpeace and the Rainforest Foundation, to advisory roles for governments, businesses, and international agencies. He writes regularly on climate change issues, and he's written two books, including one that I know you may have heard of, Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change, written for a general public audience on the psychology of climate change. I put a link to it in the chat. We can't recommend it enough. George is incredibly well-respected throughout the larger climate community. We're so honored to have you with us today, George. And with George is Thomas Erb. Tom is the Partner Relations Coordinator for the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition at the World Bank. In this role, he coordinates 275 Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition partners in advocacy, communication, and knowledge initiatives to advance carbon pricing implementation around the globe, and he's from San Diego, California, not too far from CCL's headquarters. So if we've done our job well, we'll pursue the following agenda here. Today, we're going to focus first on backgrounds and key findings from the report. George is then going to review improving the standard narrative, as well as challenges to communicating around carbon pricing. He'll then jump into some specific applications to the Energy Innovation Act for all of us U.S. listeners, and then provide some ground rules for effective conversations before jumping into Q&A. So with that, let me pass it to Tom. And Tom, it's so such an honor to have you here on the line today for the CPLC. I'll let you take it from here and then introduce George.
Great. Thank you so much, Brett. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank everyone for taking the time to join. Of course, it's great to have George here as well. So we'll turn it over here to him shortly. And briefly, just to start, so I got involved in carbon pricing originally through CCL. So I always love to throw that out there when I like talking about my own story as far as carbon pricing goes. But CCL was the first community that really brought me in to learn about carbon pricing. So that was an honor. I know all the good work that you all are doing. So just to give some overview, I'm here at the World Bank. We have an entire unit focused on carbon pricing. And a part of that is the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition and the Partnership for Market Readiness. And these are the two programs that commission the Guide to Communicating Carbon Pricing. So the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition, which I work most of my time with, is focused on the advocacy sides of things. So with our 275 partners, we work on communications initiatives, convening power, private sector engagement, knowledge creation, all these different initiatives to try to elevate carbon pricing, both at the country level, but also at the regional and international level. The Partnership for Market Readiness is more on the technical capacity building side. So they work with a lot of 20 specifically developing countries to help them develop and design carbon pricing systems on the technical side. So where we're coming from it on the Guide to Communicating Carbon Pricing is we know that we have about 57 carbon pricing initiatives across the globe. We know we've seen increasing momentum over about the last decade, but we also know that the existing systems and the existing programs are insufficient, right? Prices are not high enough, that are increasing at a rate that is necessary to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement and beyond. And there's not enough initiatives to cover all the different emissions. So the point is, carbon pricing is a key component of any climate policy package, and we know our ambition to this point is insufficient. So there's a lot of different factors that contribute to that, but we came to the conclusion that communication is a key part of this, right? So understanding how we can communicate the case for carbon pricing, depending on who your audience is, right? So World Bank, we have a different audience than if you're a government, than if you're a private sector actor. So how can you actually do the research, do the necessary background, stakeholder engagement, to understand what your communication plan could look like, right? So that's really what George and Dara and the rest of the team dived into in this report, is looking at where does the research stand? How can we help governments, private sector actors, civil society organizations design effective communication strategies? So the basic line is communication is critical to the support of carbon pricing, and we hope this report will help some of our partners do a better job of communicating to their audience. Now, George, in this process, did a very good job of also helping us better understand how we could be better communicators on carbon pricing. He did it with a light touch, but it's critically important, because as you go through this process, you learn about some of the messages that you're just have put into your mind basically on instinct that are completely against the research as far as how you should be communicating. So I think this is a critical conversation. I thank Brett and all of you for tuning in, and I'm going to hand over to George to really get into the meat of this report, and then I'm happy to stick around and answer any questions as well.
Thanks, Brett. Thanks, Tom. Hi, everybody. Hello, hello, all of you CCL people. Wonderful to be doing this again with you. I have huge respect for you and what you're doing, and in particular, always a lot of respect for people in this deeply, bitterly poisoned, polarized societies that we live in. I mean, we here in Britain as well, I'm sure you've heard on the news about what we're going through. People who try and build bridges, find ways of building across political divides with common sense policy, which speak to a broad set of values, which I think is the key to what you're doing. That's very much close to my heart, and it's one of the key things which I work on in climate outreach, is trying to find ways of breaking down these divides and speaking more broadly. So hello all of you. Thanks for your kind words, Debbie. Nice to see you again. I'm going to go over and I'm going to make my presentation, if I may. And as Brett has said, any questions you have, please put in the chat line and we will come to those as we go. So I mean, the starting point on this, I think, is to say, well, why is communication so important? The communications has been really undervalued, broadly speaking, by policymakers and by governments. Probably not many of you know this, but all governments have a commitment, a legal commitment to communicating about climate change and its causes, its impacts, and its solutions. They're bound by that, by Article 6 of the Framework Convention on Climate Change, and Article 12 of the Paris Agreement, likewise, and they've singularly failed to do this. When, therefore, they bring in a policy such as carbon pricing, they're dropping it into a field which they have not actually prepared. And consequently, things can go horribly, horribly wrong. And so one of the starting points that we say when we're talking to governments, why they need to be thinking seriously about communications, is because if they don't, you get things like this happening. This is in Australia, where carbon pricing, it wasn't necessarily even a tax, it was a complex mechanism, landed into a polarized political environment which just shredded it, which ripped it apart, and ultimately brought down the government as one of a number of issues. One of the key things to say about the Australian example, by the way, was that it wasn't just the policy itself, but it was how it landed in terms of public perceptions of trust in the government. So it was seen as a symptom of wider issues of distrust and dishonesty by government. So one of the first things to say for you is policies, including carbon pricing policies, don't sit in isolation. It's the way that they engage, and very often they become a proxy for deeper concerns. So this is what happened in Australia. And this, of course, more recently is what happened in France with the Yellow Jacket protests, which started over the imposition of a carbon price on the fuel, but once again became a proxy for wider issues of trust, fairness, social justice, where it was felt that the government was imposing a tax, and many of these protesters were saying that it was reducing tax on the rich and laying a tax on the poor. So the thing which is really important to remember is that it is a particularly a case with these pricing policies that they meet, they create an interface with the existing public attitudes towards government, towards issues of fairness, of trust, and of justice. And however your policies, including the dividend proposals, fit, we have to be thinking about how they meet with those existing political attitudes. The work I'm going to be reporting today is the Guide to Communicating Carbon Pricing. I haven't provided a link, because to be honest, if you just Google Guide for Communicating Carbon Pricing, it takes you there, because there is only one Guide to Communicating Carbon Pricing. It's the one we wrote, which I think in itself is symptomatic. I mean, governments have been running this for years and years and years and have never actually really done the core research. And that is one of the reasons we have this kind of mess. It was produced, as you heard from Tom, for the commissioned by the Partnership for Market Readiness and the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition. And the lead authors was ourselves and Climate Focus, and especially my colleague Dara Conway at Climate Focus. They are a consultancy and they very much specialize in carbon pricing policy. We worked over in the States with Fenton Associates, David Fenton, who are communications and marketing specialists in climate change and communications, and Louise Comeau, who is an academic in Canada, who contributed a lot. So I'm just going to draw out some of the key findings on that. Of course, it was not written for activists, but there is a separate document, and we can circulate the link to that, which is a briefing for civil society organizations. So there is separate material on this specific to community organizations. Right. I'll start at the top and then I'll unpack it. Key findings, right? First of all communications, this is consistent for all climate change communications, actually need to speak to people's values and their identity. We need to be finding how we speak to what people are, what makes them proud, what gives them a sense of who they are, what their core values are. And not surprisingly, and you are already know this is built into your DNA, speaking to people on the left and speaking to people on the right means appealing to different sets of values. On the left, it might be values about opportunity, moving ahead, aspirational values and fairness. On the right, it might be more values of social justice and equality. So we already have a different ways of speaking. Trust and fairness, I've already highlighted, are critically important for how these policies land. They need to address salient concerns, salient meaning what's really front of mind for people. And the truth is climate change is still not a front of mind issue for most people. Therefore, we need to ask, what is front of mind? And are there ways that we can be talking about these policies which really speak to what those key and important concerns are? In other words, if you go to people and you say, what really concerns you right now? And what are the key issues you think the government should address? That, in a way, starts to tell you what are the issues which our policies need to speak to. And for some people, that will be climate change, but for most people, it will not be. And therefore, maybe one of the questions we will explore is whether climate change should be the key framing for policies. Visible use of revenues. I'm going to talk about that. And of course, that's very relevant to you because you're following a dividend policy. But that is not necessarily what we would recommend, but we can explore that and maybe talk about it in the conversation. There's an evidence base. So as we were already hearing from Tom, most governments and communicators walk into this quite blithely without an appreciation of what works and what doesn't work, very often saying the wrong things and never having tested it. All of us as communicators, you guys as advocates, you need to be aware that a lot of what we say and do might not work. We assume it works because it's what we use and what other people around us use. But it's kind of shocking coming from an activist background, but virtually nothing that activists and campaigners say has ever been tested. They just use the language which they think works because they like it. And that is very dangerous. Like everything we do, we have to know, does it work? That's the challenge. Does it work? Have you tested it? And the majority of communications has not been tested. So our recommendations are based on testing and evidence. That's really important. And anything that you do needs to be tested. And the testing doesn't just have to be some academic research or marketing agency. It might just simply be conversations you have with people, with family, with friends, with people in the street. Every time you talk to somebody, you have a conversation. That is a little experiment, a mini focus group where you are trying out messages. So I'll come back to this point. Say things, think, that didn't work. I wonder why. Or think, that worked really well. I wonder why. And really use everything you do, every single interaction as a way to build your personal evidence base. And the communication design is iterative. In other words, we don't just say, here's the message, let's go out and do it. We say, here's the message, let's try it. That worked, that didn't work. Well, let's change it, let's adjust it. There is no gold standard. We are all finding our way on this. We've never faced a problem like this before, and so we are having to test the ground with each step. And finally, good communications need good policy. And we did say this very clearly to governments. Don't come up with a lousy, badly conceived, messy policy and then think that communications is going to sort it out. It isn't. Like any kind of salesmanship, you need a good product to sell. Otherwise, it's snake oil. And we are already dealing with a situation where people are distrustful of many of the communicators, especially government. So we need to be very clear that we have something that can be communicated. The standard narrative on carbon pricing looks a bit like this. When we did our research, we had a look, by the way, at a lot of political speeches and government communications. And it starts by talking about climate change in a very negative way. Climate change. Dangerous. It's costly. It's very expensive. It's a threat in the future that we need to address. And the reason is, therefore, we need to put a price on carbon because there's a future cost which is not being addressed in current costs and economic prices. So we're going to put a price on carbon because at the moment those costs, future costs, are not reflected in current costs. And this is how it works. And then they explain how it works. Because the idea is now that we pay a small cost now in order to avert a bigger cost in the future. Oh, and by the way, when we do this, there's other benefits too. So we might have a bit of clean air and we might have a bit of this and that. So that, generally speaking, is the structure of the normal discourse. And it doesn't work. There are a whole number of ways that we can pull this apart and say this doesn't work. This is the kind of way of speaking which comes naturally to economists who have a very technocratic, theory-driven approach to things and talk about cost in their own way. Politicians often tend to be economic and tend to be policy-led. When I was writing my book on why people avoid climate change, one of the key contributors to that was Daniel Kahneman. Daniel Kahneman is a Nobel Prize winner. He won the Nobel Prize in economics for understanding and disentangling the psychology of how people make decisions. And he pointed out that many of the ways we think and talk about climate change really work against people's innate psychology. As he says, economists think what people ought to do, and psychologists watch what they actually do. And what his research shows this, talking about cost, people might pay a cost in the present for a benefit. They're not very keen to pay a cost in the present for a long-term benefit. They're really unwilling to pay a cost in the future to avoid a long-term cost. And they really, really don't want to pay a short-term cost to avoid an uncertain long-term cost. So when we frame things in terms of, hey, we have to pay a fee now or a cost now in order to avoid a major long-term cost of climate change, Professor Kahneman says we are pressing absolutely the worst, kind of our worst psychological weaknesses. So the first thing I would flag up for you guys is be very careful of this language. Talking about climate change as a cost, works with economists, it doesn't work with people. Framing things in terms of costs now, costs in the future, we need to put, even I have to say the language, we need to put a price on carbon, is problematic because that flags up for people that the language is about putting an extra price on something. And that is a problem. And I haven't looked at your language in CCL, but I have to say most carbon pricing language focuses on this. Flag that up, first point to you. Be wary of language about cost, price, and so on. Next thing, we got to be careful of this economic language. One of the economists we spoke to said you need to remember economists are not normal people. I mean, they're not. They're specialists. It's like when doctors use technical language or going to your car mechanic and they start speaking, car mechanics speak, specialists speak their specialist language. We have to be very careful of language around economics. As I will say a little bit later on, some of the language which you use around how, about how the your proposals are revenue neutral, don't really, in my view, speak very well to people's common understanding or language. This point I made about actually how actually explaining it might be a problem, we can't tell you who said this, unfortunately, because he asked to be confidential. But I have to say, somebody who'd done an immense amount of work on practically communicating carbon pricing found that explaining, in this case, emissions trading, created a problem. Now, I know you're not dealing with emissions trading. You're dealing with fee and dividend. But there is something happens when you get too deep into explaining it. But people start saying, what is this? How does this work? And again, it gets into this economic language. So really important to focus on what it does rather than how it works. And this is particularly the case of emissions trading, which is complex, and people suspect there's a bit of, what can I say, a double dealing going on with it. Orientate the language to national circumstances. Now here, I'm going to draw on the wider research, but it applies to what you're doing. It goes back to that point, speak to what really concerns people. What are their salient concerns? So for example, in California, there is support for action on climate change, but people are a little bit wary about the language and the framing of carbon pricing. And so the focus there has been on showing what it does. Say, hey, this money is doing really great stuff. It's paying for light rail. It's paying for, for electrification of transport. It's paying for public transport. It's paying for solar panels. In other words, show what it's paying for. And I'll come back to this point. Interestingly, in Chile, the primary concern was not climate change, but was air pollution. And so the policy which they're putting together, the program they're putting together in Chile, is one where the language focuses on air pollution. And the carbon tax is built into a set of measures to reduce air pollution and is paying for some abatement measures. So in other words, same thing. It's like, hey, we're going to clean up the air and this is how we pay for it. We're going to put a tax on. So again, leading on people's primary concerns rather than climate change, rather than the economic model. But hey, this is what you're concerned about. This is what it does. It does this, and this is how it pays for it, right? So this thing about visible revenue use, I want to flag up. The recommendation we make to governments is that maybe, now there's a maybe, all of these things are maybes, right? But maybe they should start by thinking about what the money does and then put that front and foremost. In other words, saying this is what it does, this is great, this is popular, and this, by the way, is what pays for it, rather than saying climate change is a huge threat and this is why we need to pay money for it. This, incidentally, these pictures are kind of fun. This is from California, where to make it visible, they had a guy bring in his truck, and he had a kind of gas-guzzling old diesel truck. They put it in a crusher. They had this big pneumatic crusher that they put on the front lawn of the legislature, and then they gave him an electric-powered vehicle to drive away on, or a hybrid, I think it was. So this is kind of nice. But it's about making it visible and making it tangible to people. This is harder for you because you're talking about a dividend system. But I'm still sharing with you the general recommendation. And maybe for your communications, you might like to highlight the dividend ahead of your communications. A lot of this, by the way, is not just about do this, not this. It's about the structure of communication. So what do you put front of field? What is the first thing you lead on and what comes further behind? On climate change communications, climate change should always be in there somewhere, but we don't necessarily have to lead with climate change. We might lead with health. We might lead with air quality. We might have climate change as a secondary aspect. Canada, there has been more work done in Canada on carbon pricing and carbon pricing communication than the rest of the world put together. We help contribute to this. There have been a whole lot of agencies and researchers involved with this. There's been research over the past 8 years. I'm just going to very quickly draw on this, but a lot of this is built into our report. We tested a lot of language, these which narratives which we in Climate Outreach developed, and we tested. What is interesting, I might flag up for you, is that the language which was optimal and the language which crossed political boundaries, remember, we were looking for language which did not fuel polarization but actually helped to break it down, framed communications around fairness. So this is something really to flag up for you in CCL. Carbon pricing is a fair way to share responsibility, to reward. This is also a very conservative notion. Reward the people who are doing the right thing and put a price and punish for people who are doing the wrong thing. Okay, for pollution on the air, we all breathe. So there's a health framing, which I already know. I know you already use in your communications. So just to say fairness. Fair is important. And if I was doing the stuff of CCL, I would be really putting, this is fair, right up front. Trusted communicators, really important. We need to have trusted people talking. And again, I know that you've done this very well in CCL, getting people across the political spectrum and so on. We're saying it again. Right. Trust is so central on this issue. Always trust, trust, trust. Now, we need to recognize, unfortunately, that many of the communicators in the climate change field, the media, celebrities, advocacy organizations, government and politicians are polarizing. They're trusted by their supporters. They are actively distrusted by other people. And so I think we need to have a lot of different people speaking in different ways to different audiences. We definitely can't assume that there's anybody who works across the board, because I'm afraid there isn't. Right. Here are three challenges for communicating carbon pricing. Challenge one. Do you proactively communicate the carbon pricing at all? In other words, do you just do it? Now, this is less of a concern for you because you are involved with the communicating of carbon pricing, but it is an issue for governments. Maybe carbon pricing can just be simply built into some other existing policy, fiscal reform, such you don't even need to tell people about it. I'm not sure about that. I think it can blow up and it can bite you if you don't. But it is a question. And it's a question, I guess, on your proposals as well. Could they in some way be built into something else or put alongside something else, like generally speaking, broad fiscal reform that got the same objectives without actually having to have a whole debate about climate change? Secondly, how much and whether or not do we focus on climate change? And I think this is definitely an issue for you. Like, your language at the moment is strongly about climate change. You use the language of carbon built right into what you're doing. But I'd say it's not a matter of ignoring climate change. There was a disastrous period in US climate change communications where people just said, hey, don't even talk about climate change. Let's talk about renewables, clean energy. Let's leave the climate change thing on one side. And I think that's a huge mistake, because you really do need to talk about climate change. It's happening. It's happening big time. And we need to be talking about it as much as we can. But we might not put it front of all of our communications. For some audiences, we might want to talk about other benefits or other ways of framing it around these salient concerns. And as we know, pollution might be a strong one there. Green economy might be strong. For example, if we're saying we are going to invest the revenues from a carbon tax in renewables, the primary communication might be around renewables. We're going to have clean energy. We're going to do it. Oh, and this is good for climate change. Maybe it could be a renovation of housing stock. That would be a big issue, for example, in Eastern Europe, where housing stock is very bad. You could have a carbon tax there, and you could say, we are going to have clean, safe, healthy, affordable housing for everybody. Oh, and by the way, how are we paying for this? We're paying for it with a carbon tax, because that's a good place to pay for it. So there's lots of different ways of framing. And there is a serious question I'd always say about, like, does climate change really need to be front of your communications? Maybe, or maybe something else. Or maybe different audiences have different approaches. Like we would say, you know, different folks, different strokes. Yeah? So maybe different audiences, I guess what we would try and say in communications terms is you have different ways of speaking, and they're like a deck of cards, and you might deal them slightly differently for different audiences. Finally, carbon tax. Do you call it a tax? Now, there have been a lot of experiments with this, and we do talk about this in the guide that we wrote for PRMC PLC. Do we call it a tax? Do we call it a charge? Do we call it a fee? Do we call it a levy, a carbon price? There's pros and cons on this. The pro, of course, is that calling it something that isn't a tax is that taxes are unpopular. Taxes, as we know, is a major source of pushback, where we've had a reaction and people fighting against taxes. And it's a negative framing. It's framing it as a cost, and people resent it. However, there are also strong reasons for calling it a tax. And my personal orientation is to call a tax. To say, yeah, it's a tax. We need taxes. And you know what? The general attitude on this is that conservatives hate taxes. That's not entirely true. Conservatives recognize the need for taxes. Their issue is about how the taxes are spent and how much and how heavy the taxes are, right? Not necessarily tax itself. There's something to be said for just going in there and saying, yeah, it's a tax. Sure, it's a tax. But it's the right kind of tax. Governments who ran into problems, this is, for example, the situation with the Australian government, they went in with something saying, no, we are not going to do a tax. This was the language which they tried to have. They said, we're not going to have a carbon tax. We're not going to do any taxes. We're going to have a levy. And then something came along which looked strangely like a tax. And for the Julia Gillard government, the problem there was that the fight against them by Tony Abbott was of saying, hey, you said there wouldn't be any taxes and there was a tax. In other words, something which she said wasn't a tax, but the opposition could claim was a tax, became a proxy for wider issues of trust. So I would say, yeah, you know what, call it a tax. Straight honest talking, it's a tax, and then just go in there and do that. But, test it. Test. Some of the testing shows that people are more receptive if it is described as a charge or a levy. Yeah, you know, I'm a little wary of this kind of testing because it's quite isolated. It's, if you just present people with two choices, they probably would go for that. But it's removed from a wider context. I think my own view is that tax works. But you know what? It's a fair debate, but it's an important question. Right. So what might be a better way to talk about it? You know, at the beginning I said the standard way of talking doesn't work very well. Well, we would recommend something which might look a bit like this. This, by the way, is a formulation that is not in the final recommendations in our guide. So this is me talking as climate outreach rather than from the report we wrote for CPLC. Building from a trust. So somebody already, you know me, you can trust me. I think is important, like having somebody who's trustworthy. Starting with what the thing does. This is going to be great. Sounding a bit like Donald Trump. Hey, this is going to be so great. we're going to do something great and something popular. And I guess this is where the issue of leading with revenue use pays off best, if one can do it. Because then the argument is of saying, well, how are you going to pay for this great thing you're going to do? Solar panels or electrification, or it could be anything. It doesn't even have to be about the environment. Well, it's not going to be paid for by your income taxes or business profits. It's going to be a charge on pollution, which is causing these problems, dirtying our air. And that's a very fair way of putting things back in balance. By the way, oh, I'm sorry, there's a typo there with people. By the way, this idea of balance is really important, and it's a real key to the values of people at the more conservative end of a political spectrum. This is very reasonable. This is very sensible. This is very fair. This is a very balanced kind of policy. In other words, something just before coming on this call, I was looking through a whole lot of focus group research we just did with conservatives in Germany. And it's so interesting. German conservatives, American conservatives, British conservatives all have similar kinds of ways of seeing the world, which is that they think that a lot of the people involved, they think climate change is a problem, but they think a lot of the people involved in the debate are extremists, they're too extreme, they're too radical. So what they're looking for is something which is reassuring. It's just very sensible. So very much in terms of that. And putting a balance back. So a balance in the sense of things are out of balance. You know, right now, people can pump pollution into the atmosphere and they don't pay anything for it. That's not right. That's not right, is it? Surely it's fair that if you're dirtying the air that we all breathe, that you should pay something towards it. It's that kind of language. So here again is a set of the key findings we talked about. I've kind of covered most of those grounds, I think. And again, I talked a little bit about testing. We can go back to some of this on our Q&A. I made a few notes on the Energy Innovation Carbon Dividends Act. Just a few observations. I notice you're speaking to health issues. Great. Health, we know, is an issue which crosses well. We need to know, however, that it has different salience in different places. You know, like, you know, there are places where people believe that their natural environment is very healthy. And therefore, you know, telling people in, you know, in rural areas with clean air that they're going to have to pay more money on their gasoline is a bit tricky, because they probably drive long distances, and saying, hey, it's about clean air, they're going to say, well, hell, we already have clean air. We did a lot of research, by the way, in Alberta. And if you're interested, do have a look. We wrote a whole report on communicating climate change in Alberta, which is utterly polarized, probably even more so than anywhere in America, even in Texas. I mean, it's 50-50 down the middle between people who believe climate change is a threat and people who don't. And we found health language semi-worked, but not very well there, because they think they have clean air. So, you know, we have to be careful with that. Their language, by the way, that worked was much more about balance and much more of a sense for the dependence on oil was making people insecure. Generally, your language is very good on your bipartisan framing, and that's always what I like about CCL and what you do. You talk about revenue neutral. I'm just warning you that that's economist jargon. I think most people don't understand what that means, and you might want to find other ways of talking about that. And you're offering dividend, not use of revenue use. Now, you need to know that the research on dividends, on kind of like fee and dividend, is mixed. On the one hand, people like the idea of it, and they like the idea of getting the money back from the government. They like the idea of revenue neutral, though you don't have to use that phrase, but the idea that the government isn't taking a cut. That being said, we tested some of this language, and we found that people are skeptical of that. In other words, they are skeptical that this isn't some kind of smoke and mirrors exercise for the government to take more money off them and spend it on what it wants. There's really serious issues with trust. And part of the problem with this is that people are skeptical of government taking money out of one pocket and putting it into another. And incidentally, when we did in January this year, we did language testing across Canada, and we tested some of this And we found that is exactly the language which comes to mind for people when they're thinking about dividend. There aren't clear conclusions on this, but I'm just warning you that it's not straightforward, and there's quite a lot of space to explore on this. And the reason I here say watch Canada is because Canada is now a large national scale experiment in this. So you might be aware, several provinces in Canada have a carbon price. And the situation is that they were encouraged by they were told by the government that they had the right as a province to impose the carbon price any way they wished. So several have. As we know, British Columbia already has a carbon tax. Other states are exploring taxes, or they're exploring emissions trading. Some refuse to do so. Most notably Ottawa said, no, we're not having anything to do with that. And so what's happening there, Alberta also, so what's happening there is that the government is imposing tax and dividend. It is going to be sending people in those provinces a check in the post for the distribution of the money that's been raised in the tax. Let's see how that lands. And let's see how it's communicated. So I think something very interesting for you guys is, as we go through and the federal election in Canada, I think it's going to be in October, go through and let's just see what works, what doesn't work, because it has major implications for what you do. Maybe it works amazingly well. Maybe, for all we know, Justin Trudeau comes in, you know, with a landslide, and the reason for it is because people loved getting those checks in the post. Maybe it doesn't make any difference one way or the other, or maybe it generates distrust, like, hey, what is this? What do you mean? Why are you sending me this money? And I met with the Canadian Minister of Environment. We talked with her and flagged up for her that in this situation of distrust, there is a danger that sending people checks in the post is problematic on the run-up to an election. In other words, sending money to people is not value neutral when it comes from the government. People are wondering, what is this for, and what do they want from me? So there's a bunch of issues there. Let's see how it lands in Canada. Final points before we go to questions here. You might be wanting to talk with people. We have an interesting program that's just kicking off now, which is called Talking Climate, hashtag Talking Climate. And if anybody is interested in this, and if CCL would like to join, please do. We're doing it as a pilot at the moment. We've got 500 participants who are there having a training from us in how to have climate change conversations. And then what they're doing is recording and collecting the conversations they have. So we're trying to understand what works when you have climate change conversations. What works, what doesn't work, how do those conversations go, and how do we get better at it? So evidence-based, social, citizen science. And if any of you guys would like to take part, and I'll quickly summarize some of the findings of that. Three key ground rules: respect, hold your truth, ask and listen. So if you are communicating CCL or the policy or why we need to have a carbon price, what you might like to do is to follow a structure like this. You have an opening with somebody. Maybe that's an opening about, hi, I want to talk to you about this. Or maybe it's just a conversation you have with somebody on a train. I mean, I had one on the way here today. They happen all the time. You just talk with people. Hey, I think it's climate change. Validate what people are. Listen to them and say, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I think that's important. Like, always follow up with people, and as much as possible in the conversation, recognize and respect and follow up with them and validate what they're saying. State your position clearly. So just say, well, this is what I think. I think climate change is a threat. I think we need to have a policy. I think we need to do this. And then follow up by saying, hey, well, that's what I think. What do you think? And then go into a situation where you're listening to people. So I think a lot of this will be second nature to you. But I think there is a tendency for us to go into conversations and just say, hey, this is what's important. We need to do something on this. Climate change is a big problem. So just to speak about what we need to do or how it is a problem, rather than saying, hey, I think this is what we should do. It's really important to me. I care about my kids. This is what I want. What do you think? I'd really like to know. That is a much more positive conversation. And it goes back, I guess, to that point I was saying about how every conversation is like a social experiment, listening to people, learning from them, not interrupting, not talking over them. When I'm in the States, I love talking with conservatives because I'm really interested in finding out what's going on for them. What do they think about climate change? What do they think about Donald Trump? And I just say, hey, I'm a Brit. I'd love to know what's going on. You know, we're having a few problems at home as well, and I'd love to hear from you guys. Well, what are you thinking at the moment? Because that's fascinating. And just coming to people with openness, respect, a sense of shared values. We're all facing problems together. Let's learn from each other. Okay.
Brilliant, George. Thank you so much for obviously all that you're working through here. And the chat has been erupting with appreciation for the work that Climate Outreach is doing here. And it was exactly what we were hoping for the overview.
No, thanks.
If anyone has questions, you have my email. I can forward them on to Tom or George as fit. But I know that I'm speaking for everyone on behalf of this line. We know both of you are so busy, especially leading up to the UN Climate Week and all the other important work that you're doing, that you have given this time to really help our own framing communications. So I'm going to unmute all lines so that we can send you off with a big hurrah, and a shout of gratitude from everyone throughout the larger world. So thank you so much, George and Tom, and here all lines are unmuted.
Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Excellent information.
Thank you, George. Thanks, Tom and Brett.
Thank you.
Jolly good.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.